Hello, and welcome to this week's The Proteomics Show. This is our B-Sides series.
Hi, I'm Ben Osborne, and I'm here with Dr. Benjamin Neely. And this episode features Henry Rodriguez, who is from the National Cancer Institute and is the founding director of the Office of Cancer Clinical Proteomic Research.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we talked about his role at CBTAC and, you know, Cancer Moonshot, but also how he got there. You know, as he says, he never could have written the script. So definitely enjoy. All right. Hello. Welcome. Henry, thanks for coming on the show today.
Hey, thanks, guys.
So I'm going to start off first. We've been doing the podcast for a while, and you were actually one of the people on the VMO when I floated this idea, which is Benai's idea, way back when, and you were one of the people that was like supportive of this idea.
Yeah.
And so I want to say like thank you for doing that, because we didn't actually think it was that great of an idea, because otherwise someone would have done it. But we've enjoyed it. Oh, and because I looked it up, we're in 67 countries now.
Nice. You know, very nice.
So we're like,
very nice.
So a bunch of strange people listening to us. Okay, but first off,
we have to convert it in a multiple language just to make sure, because that is a lot of exposure.
Yeah,
do that.
You had to do that.
Get the Netflix people on it. But seriously. But thank you. And so thank you for coming on. So for people that don't know you, and actually that would be me as well, and what you do, can you just briefly describe, you know, like what you're doing, what you do?
Yeah, sure. So currently what I do is I'm at the National Cancer Institute, and what I do there is I help to oversee activities. These are all predominantly extramurally driven activities. So these are the ones that we fund research laboratories throughout the U.S. And their goal is to basically be taking the science that a lot of us love, which is proteomics. But the spin that we've put on it is we don't decouple it with the genomics landscape. So for all the samples that we obtain from our patients, all of them will undergo that comprehensive genomics, also with the comprehensive proteomic characterization. And in addition to that, we also do have laboratories out in Frederick here in Maryland, where we actually have other activities that we conduct inside of the NCI. And some of them actually do have public resources components to them. But those are pretty much what I do. So we're one of those portfolio managers that we oversee extramural grants, and then we work with the investigators in a collaborative manner to ensure that the science actually meets the expectations that people apply to, and it fits the overall goals of these larger scale initiatives that we launch here at the NCI.
Wow. Okay, it sounds like a lot of things.
That was a big mouthful.
We assumed it was a lot of things. Right.
Yeah.
So how hard of a sell is that, right? Genomics is big time, right? Especially in cancer.
Right.
Are we at a point now where the proteomics is accepted to go side by side with that? Or do you feel like this is that an uphill battle at all?
Yeah. That's a really good question. I mean, from my sense, It's always, for now, it's still sort of a secondary, I think. I mean, you have to understand the past, right? To me, that's critical to understand where the science has evolved. And it's not because one is better than the other scientifically. My philosophy is I go back to what I learned in college, right? When you crack a book of biochemistry, Leninger or whoever is there, the first thing you learn in cell biology is you got a DNA. The DNA goes into your RNA, and ultimately you get your proteins, right? So it's that full gamut. But if you look at the history of where technology has really evolved, you can really trace it back, the year 2000, right? When that first genome project, the first draft gets rolled out. That was a genomic-driven activity. So by default, people have always felt that from a technology perspective and the potential for that genomic landscape was the first one out the door. Then sort of what happens over the history. When the genomics, that blueprint gets laid out, quickly proteomics jumps on board, which is good in a way. Unfortunately, while there were really good science that was done, there were some studies that they sort of overhyped or some of the major flagship studies, they did have a lot of serious flaws within them. And maybe it was also a case that technology yet wasn't really mature at the time. So fast forward to today, the genomics has always kept up from a technology perspective ahead of the pace of the proteomics landscape, at least from my personal perspective. But I personally see it more and more is that people recognize that while genomics does take you so far, and at least in oncology, we cannot deny the advances that have been made. But I always remind my colleagues is there's a lot of people that unfortunately succumb to cancer. So clearly we have not been able to unravel that underlying biology to where we thought we could unravel just going off of one omics. So they do recognize that if you complement the strength and the weaknesses of the genomics landscape with the strength and the weaknesses of the proteomics right above it, you get a far better picture of that biology overall. So I still think it is, from the public's perception, if you talk precision medicine, people always will think genomics. And it's just because of the history that's been involved there. But I do think over time, if you're in that biomedical research space, you do recognize that you gotta be now linking proteomics, because from a technology perspective and from a reproducibility, from being able to be reproducible, it absolutely has caught up. And in some instances, it's even better within my perspective.
Okay. So in your, where does the clinical come in? Anyway, so clinical proteomics.
So twofold, right? I've always viewed it as there's a huge window when people always want to push the clinical arm. I think the beauty of any of these omic technologies is that you're first going to figure out the biology. Without understanding the biology, at least from my view, you're blind moving into the clinical space. I mean, you can look at the genomics landscape, right? I mean, from at least from the National Cancer Institute's perspective, what we ended up doing there, if my memory serves me correct, was from a timeline perspective, 25 years ago, the first draft of that genome project comes out. 5 years later, to NCI's credit, it then, one of our advisory boards says, what can we do within this omic landscape way of trying to understand the biology? And they wanted to understand it from an oncology perspective. So our National Cancer Advisory Board spins out a working group. That working group actually got, you know, co-chaired by two individuals. One happens to be Eric Lander, the time was at the Broad Institute, genomics straight background. And then you got a Nobel laureate, Leland Hartwell, at the time was the president of the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center. So the working group comes back to the NCI, and they basically gave this recommendation, go after the characterization, genomics and proteomics. And they had a bunch of other stuff in there. But what's interesting is you could go back to today, and there's been huge advancements that we know that have now been made with the genomics landscape, and move that now into the clinic, especially, for example, lung cancer. But there's still lots of stuff that hasn't translated, and that's nearly 25 years. Mm. I think proteomics, from my view, it's still in that understanding and complementing the clinical implication. And I've always seen the biggest advantages is that if you're able to partner with the clinical trial space, then at that point, when those trials a lot might be driven to a genomic-based approach, when the outcomes in whichever arm that's there does not give you the outcome that you thought the patient would actually have, so what do, right? Because genomics only took you so far. You complement that now with the protein landscape, then you're able to have new avenues, new hypotheses that begin to drive future iterations of clinical trials. So I still see it from that biomedical research environment versus, here's a clinical application that is widely, deployed throughout the patient care community. I think that will come, but I still focus it more on our strength and the beauty falls in that biomedical research environment.
Okay, so where does CBTAC fall in this? Is CBTAC... Because is CBTAC a subsection of this, or is it the majority of this initiative?
Yeah. So CBTAC has sort of this cool, interesting past. And for that, you got to go into what I would say back into those old, hallways of the NCI. So if Okay, so let's go back to that period of 2005, right? So the National Cancer Advisory Board spits out that working group. The working group comes back, and the recommendation that comes back to the NCI is go after this idea of trying to catalog all the various perturbations, just characterize tumors at the molecular level, right? Because the vision has always been, can you begin to define cancer off the molecular space, right? So that's around 2005, 2006, to the credit of NCI, it begins to implement a lot of those recommendations. The first one that they launched in 2006 was the Cancer Genome Atlas, right? So that's one that a lot of people are familiar with. And TCGA basically went after these samples are all treatment naive, and you basically catalog the stuff. So what you're going to figure out is biology. That's it, right? You really can't push the clinical aspect as much. But the NCI, what they did, that was during the period that the protein landscape was sort of those controversial papers that were coming out. So they did, which is what I'm glad, which is why they brought me on board, was at least they recognized the value of the protein, right? Because that follows that continuum, DNA, RNA to protein. They knew that they have to do this. But because of what happened within the analytical side, within those publications, and when studies were done, they at least said, look, we'll create CPTAC. But CPTAC will not go after biology. What your charge is going to be initially when you're born, along with TCGA, which we believe that from an analytical perspective, these things are solid. CPTAC, you're going to try to come back with these platforms that people were using at the time, which is mass spectrometry. And you're going to come back and give us a recommendation on whether or not these methodologies could be standardized and be reproducible. And quite frankly, not reproducible just in your lab, but in multiple laboratories. Tell us what you can do. So that was what, 2006, over a five-year window, we basically went after the analytical, the standardization space. So that was phase one. Phase two, then we come back to our boards. And the question is, so what do you now do? TCGA is off and running. CPTAC, now you've demonstrated you could get these analytics solidly done. So what do you do? Well, we partner with TCGA because that was like this grand vision years in the past. And we took a couple of their samples that already went that genomic characterization. Again, pure biology. At that point, we then layered our protein measurements right above it. And we demonstrated that you're able to generate additional biology. Yeah, go figure, guys, right? That you can't obtain through as much DNA or deep RNA sequencing your hearts wish to go after. Protein biology, you know, illuminates new avenues for you. Then phase three, they loved it. So when phase three rolls around, it was now go after our own sample collections. These are samples that are optimized. So good, now for every sample, we team up with TCGA and undergoes comprehensive DNA, RNA, our sites. We do the comprehensive protein measurements on them, including the modifications, and we integrate all that stuff. Those are treatment naive samples. That's pure biology. Then we also now created at the same time, trying to catch up with where TCGA was moving towards, taking all that biology that they cataloged and then beginning to morph it into that clinical trial arena. Then we said, let's begin to pilot some laboratories that their goal would be, they do preclinical research. Again, combining DNA, RNA, and proteins, they could do it in cell culture. We really would love to see if they could do it within animal models, so like xenografts and so forth. And then they would go back to clinical trials to see if there's trials that would have samples that they conduct these correlative studies on those outcomes, especially trials that did not yield the outcome that people wanted. And we would then run our analysis on it based on the preclinical data that we did. The current iteration pretty much follows that same model, but we're trying to scale up more of those translational studies. So CPTAC today straddles those both worlds. We do the biology cataloging, which is the classic old ways of TCGA that you can kind of view at that perspective. And these are these flagship studies that we give away all that data to the public. And then, which is where I've always seen the future, which is ultimately where you'd love to go, is we also now are trying to expand that translational space again, it's not clinically deployable, but it's adding value to those clinical studies.
Got it. Yeah. No, I think whenever CBTAC comes up, like from the proteomic side, I mean, and obviously with my personal bias and everything, but you know, it's always, you know, it's like our high watermark, right? For the sample quality, the sample depth, each sample, and especially for anyone who's considering any kind of revenue recognition, you look at the depth of the CBTAC study and you think, oh my God, that is so much analysis time per sample. But then, you know, it's clearly working, right? Because there's multiple startups out there that are just, their whole business model is just applying artificial intelligence to remine CBTAC data for new stuff, right?
Yeah. Well, okay. Well, A, those are words that just made me cry. Thank you.
Okay.
No, but see, so that's part of the mission that I've always liked about this program, right? Is that the information that we generate, we've always viewed it as, and it's part of our mandate. It's pre-competitive. So you give it back to the public. And we already know that that data, the minute we release all that information to the public, including any targeted assays, we give away our SOPs, including the reagents that we use, right? If some of those targets require an affinity reagent, we also give those up to the public within the various mechanisms. But to know that your information, while you mine it the best you can, which we do, and is very slow, time-consuming process, ultimately, let's face it, you're still analyzing it within your microcosm, right? Within your little neighborhood. But then when you give it back to the public, and as people develop new algorithms, which is probably what you're referring to, that's even more rewarding because then you see how the information carries spades beyond your own program. So yeah. I mean, that is a legacy that I think is really cool about our mission.
excuse me. So to take another step back, and it's only because I didn't know this until recently, and I feel like you could probably speak to it, but like, you know, like when we were kids and there was the like Schoolhouse Rock, like how a bill becomes a bill.
Yeah.
Do you remember that? So I feel like as scientists, I don't think most of us understand, like you mentioned at the very beginning, like these larger scale initiatives. Can you just like to whatever degree you want, like talk about how do these initiatives happen? Because I really don't think 90% of the people I know. Like, how does it go from something's cool in the public eye, and then there's RFAs and people are doing it. Is that something I can ask?
Yeah. So from the big perspective, right?
Yeah.
One of the things that we always do at NIH or pretty much any organization, you kind of want to do, like in the business sector, you want to do a SWOT analysis. But for us, ultimately, what you want to get a good handle on is we put on these large workshops or think tanks, and then people get invited to those think tanks. They could be fully open. They could be folks that you kind of just bring into the field. It covers a variety of different scopes. But ultimately, what you're trying to get a handle on is you're looking outside of your people, right? Outside of your organization. And you're asking them, hey, what's the next area that you believe is going to have a huge impact in our case for NCI, in the space of oncology? And then you're also asking, well, is this an area that you see its potential within the beauty of individual laboratories conducting their own research? Or are there areas that you believe, in the case of CPTAC and TCGA, that would be best served if it's done in a coordinated manner? Right. So those are like those team-based structured programs. And each one of those need to have a justification, right? So like, why do you got to develop that? And there could be a variety of reasons behind it. And in many instances, is that you want to scale progress in a shorter window to have that output, like a factory mentality. So once we get a sense of the community weighing in, then you have folks like myself or others that then we package that, and then that gets presented to our senior management. Then once it goes to the senior management, then we start bringing in that gets presented back out to our various advisory boards. We have two of them at the NCI, Board of Scientific Advisors, also the National Cancer Advisory Board. Or in instances, they themselves could spin out And in this one instance, where you had Eric Lander, along with Leon Hartwell, that was the National Cancer Advisory Board that actually had its own working group. And that came back to the NCI for consideration. So there's a variety of ways that you kind of do it. But the key of all of them is you're trying to reach to the outside, to the people that are experts in an area, and essentially say, where's the gaps that exist today? And where are the opportunities that we should begin to capitalize on? And then how you build these neighborhoods, you know, that's a mix really within side of NIH, where we kind of look at the various ways of kind of doing it. And that could be what you just referred to. Could they be RFAs? Could they be other mechanisms? If they could be contractual, there's a variety of mechanisms that we have that actually helps to skin it. But it's typically trying to align on how best to get the output that you're trying to get from that scientific, program.
And how often does that, that's kind of like within the organization. I mean, how often does it go all the way up to like the White House and then come back down, or through Congress? Because I mean, you can still have, like, they might show, so I joke, you know, where I work, they decided that we needed to look at arsenic in apple juice. And that did not come from like our people, that came from like legislators. So, I mean, you also get that too, right? To a degree, these outside directives. I don't even know what you call that.
I'd see the easy way of viewing it, right? Is you have many people that have areas of interest. That's like the best way to phrase it in a very cordial political way, right? So let's assume that there's folks high up that do, okay, so a great example. One of the things that I've always admired about the Cancer Moonshot, right, is that was one that came out of what? The Obama-Biden administration off its tail end. And then that was one that was beautifully well aligned, where it is something that at the time, which is the Moonshot 1.0, as we could dub it now, that was something that was really spearheaded by then Vice President Biden. And that is one that when it rolls out, we happen to be the agency at the time that was heavily involved in actually conducting a lot of those activities for them, right? To fulfill that wish, to put it in a nice way. Ultimately, it's not like we just were there and said, this is what we can do. We have all these varieties of working groups. So that's a good example of one that comes from the executive side and then rolls down to one of the agencies. The ones that I'm kind of referring to are the ones where we always have, just like NIST, right? We always have our appropriations, and there's always components in there from a discretionary perspective. What you do with those dollars, that's really where those organizations make the best determinant on how to move forward with it. I remember when I was at NIST, when I did, I served for about a year as a policy analyst within the directors. And then they had, at the time, I don't know if they still have them, these competency awards. And it was really fun actually help running it for them, right? Because you're trying to look at your organization. And in that instance, you're trying to say, what are the areas within the commercial side, right? Because NIST is an enabler to the private sector. And where is the field moving? And what are the competencies that we should be developing today that puts us in a stronger position in the future? So that's a great example where you have the ability and the leadership within your own shop to help make those determinants. And as you said, there could be instances that this higher priority exists within your country. And then that now is something that you look at the various federal agencies, help us to implement it. And in many instances, there also involve public-private partnerships. I mean, did that sort of cover it for you?
I didn't have a real like goal there. I think a lot of us, like, we're super reactive. And it kind of depends on where you are in your career, but you know, you just think it's this like weird body and they have RFAs, and then you realize like you can talk to them more. And it's like, as you progress, you get more and more aware, like how it works and things like that. So I just kind of wanted to open that window just a little.
One thing that I tell everyone, one of the things that I've learned and that I always tell everyone is before I went to NIH, right, when I used to be at NIST or even before NIST, when I was back in California, I always thought NIH was like this black box, right? This big bank, I have no idea who to call and nobody wants to talk to you. I've always viewed it, and I've made it a mission of myself, which is I tell everyone, is anytime you have a question in one of the areas that you could just go online, any search engine, and you see that that's an activity that exists at any of the institutes or centers at NIH, they typically have a point of contact. Reach out to them. I've always, from my perspective, the vast majority of people typically will respond back. Anytime that there's a funding opportunity in any of these mechanisms, they typically tell you who the point of contacts are. Reach out to them, get the details, and at the same time, you could probably get other guidance and sort of an inkling in areas of directions that these different institutes or centers are beginning to explore. They should be doing it, and it gives you a great insight into what I always viewed before I came here as that black box. Because the black box, while it could be intimidating, folks inside are actually very, very willing to kind of share their knowledge with anyone that's out there. And if they don't, quite frankly, just email them multiple times.
Yeah, no. It's such good advice. And again, like I always feel like I'm constantly growing up, like one day I'll be an adult. And yeah. That was like one of them. I'm like, wait, I can just call this guy? And like, we can talk because he wants to be successful too, right? Like we want the same things. I'm glad you said that. You kind of mentioned it. So this is part of the story where we like to pivot. I think you've done incredible things, but like, how did you get to that? And really, how'd you get that drive? I think for what you're doing, we joke, you can go back to when you were like six and was it, you broke your arm and you were really passionate about what doctors were doing to fix you, but however far back you want or not, but just like, what's your path?
Oh, wow. Okay. Also, you guys got my medical records when I did break my arm.
Yeah, that's a John Yates story, actually. I don't know why I pulled that one. Yeah. He like broke his arm.
I actually did break my arm. That's why. I was like, you're a good mom, and you guys pretty much got good data.
We know. we pay.
So the easy answer is, I tell everyone the path that I finally have taken, I never would have guessed it. Never would have guessed it in my lifetime, you know? And okay, well, first of all, let me backtrack. One of the things you kind of started off, and this is the gut honest truth. People always say, it's amazing what you've done, blah, 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 within this field. I can tell you right now, I've done nothing. I mean, everything that has come out of CPTAC or the past 15, 16 years that I've now been at NCI, all the talent, and I constantly will say this, all the talent is because of those extramural investigators. And you hit the nail on the head. It's a two-way street, which is what I tell everyone. And in fact, every time a new program gets kicked off, one of the things that I like to do, which is sort of my stump speech, I kind of give them sort of a very generic inside look of what we got to go through, we being these program folks, right? And the way that I explain it to them, I say, look, it's very easy, guys. This is like, you could be like an angel or a VC. We somehow, what gets awarded goes through a peer review system. But then the process of having a success downstream, it is an open communication that has to be so transparent and has to be so honest between what you guys are doing, what you guys think you can achieve or not achieve, and having us to be a recipient of that information, whether it's good or bad. Because at the end of the day, while you guys could have a lot of successes or not so much good successes, us having the ability to convey that back to our leadership actually is the full 360 process. So the reality is it's a two-way street, but a lot of the success comes from the outside folks. And all the other folks that's involved in running these sorts of operations. Now, going back to your other one, yeah, with the broken arm, that's like a really good question, right? So for me, it's interesting. So I've never been the sharpest tech under the sun, quite frankly. But one of the things that I've always had is I've always been hungry, and I've always been persistent to keep on pecking. So people call it, oh my God, you're nagging me. But for me, it's if I truly believe in it, then I constantly will try to go after it. Even if I fail on two attempts, I just come back and figure out a third way to go in and pitch the same thing. But it sounds differently where they're like, oh, wow, so that's totally cool, right? Because at the end, you're trying to get that outcome. So the other thing that's quite cool is sort of being the underdog, right? Because everybody's against you in a way within that sort of a model. So initially, I know when I went to NCI, when I jumped from NIST, because in NIST I was doing quite well, you know, and at NCI, these programs that we run, they run off 5-year cycles. And there's really no guarantee that they go on beyond those 5-year cycles. You have to prove your scientific chops every 5 years. And then if you do well, then you have to present, well, what's the next iteration of growth? And for me, that's always been one of the most funnest things to do, right? Because you could really view it as your own kids. You see it in this blank slate, and then you see what comes in terms of these applicants. The applicants each have these incredible skill sets, right? I mean, these are people that when I go to like HUPO and other conferences, I'm in awe at the way that they view science beyond what I've always felt that I myself personally could contribute. But I always knew that I always had fun sort of trying to piece these things together and then trying to go back then and try to convince others that, yeah, this stuff is super cool. So what's been my driving factor is pure and simple. I've always believed from a background that I always had, and I came from a genomics background, is ultimately I knew early on that if you really want to understand what goes on at the biological level, and you want to understand what goes on or what does not go on favorably at the patient level when you run them through these studies, you just can't be looking at this one omic optic myoptic point of view. You got to move it towards that downstream. So trying to link them together and then trying to have the biomedical research community, the on-docs, right? So the MDs or the MD PhDs see this where they can bring it into those tumor molecular boards. That to me is the ultimate sort of happiness. And once I see that fully deployed, I think at that point, I'll be happy in life that I could just pass away.
So is your background, it sounds like it is in science, right?
It's in science. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So I'm a first generation, immigrant, right? So my parents came from Cuba to the US. My first school was a community college, right? Because of cost. And, that's down in Miami. That school was only a 2-year granting degree at the time. Today, it's a 4-year. Then I moved to the feeder school that that community college had, and that's Florida International University. There, what my minor was in, well, so I majored in biology, and then I got a minor in chemistry. At the time, I just didn't really, I knew I loved science, and I loved the medical side, but I also knew that I would faint easily when I saw blood. So that path was gone, but I enjoyed the science side of it, right? You know, like this cool geeky side. So I then decided to get a master's degree still in Miami. So that master's was again in biology, but then I started doing a stint in this idea of toxicology. And I was interested at the time on environmental compounds that would create damage to DNA. right? So like my career got anchored in DNA. And then at that point, what? I ended up going to Boston, the Boston University. And there my doctor was in cell microbiology, but again, specializing in polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, right? So the whole space involved in reactive oxygen species. And specifically, I was interested in cigarette smoking, but one of those active compounds, benzapyrene. When I finished that, then, my girlfriend at the time, because that's where I fell in love, she was from California. Hence, you could check my career path. I moved to California, got married, and then my first stint was at the Scripps Research Institute. I was in the Department of Immunology, and I was interested again in trying to understand reactive oxygen species, because it's this cool field, right? This niche area of free radicals. But then I was interested in oncogene activation. So we would take KRAS and then we would dope it with compounds, see the sites that were being modified. And then you'd go to the mutational databases, you know, you make these correlations. Then I got interested in cancer very much more on a personal level. And I've gone public with it. My mother, who's a very long-term breast cancer survivor, she developed breast cancer. That sort of changed my path. So then I quickly went from the Scripps Research Institute, moved to LA, and then I trained in Department of Oncology there within the City of Hope Cancer Research Center. And there what we were doing was we were using these PCR-based techniques, again, trying to understand different reactive oxygen species, and specifically where they would create the damage to modified bases, and then mapping that to different genes, which was kind of cool, because then you kind of look at the oncogenes again beyond KRAS, and then you say, well, if I look at patients with cancer, these are the different sites within the genes that are have gone from a modification to a full-blown mutation. Then apparently what happened to me was I got this weird bug. Well, actually, this part you'll love. So I had all intentions at that point when I was wrapping up the City of Hope to go directly into industry. I kind of knew that academia wasn't really a calling for me, but I loved the academic way of kind of viewing it. And a couple of sort of opportunities came up at the time. One was in Connecticut, there was a biotech company back then called Curigen. I got to meet folks like John Rothberg and others, you know, that moved on to other great stuff, but nothing really sort of clicked at the end, right? And then when I was looking, there was an individual at NIST that used to be at NIST. They heard one of my lectures or talks at a meeting, and then they gave me their business card. And I'll be honest, guys, like I looked at this thing called .gov and I was like, what's this? You know, everything was .edu or .com.
Sure.
And I just didn't really think much of it. And then when he said National Institute of Standards and Technology, I had no idea, even at the time. About 6 months later, nothing really was panning out in the jobs that were being offered to me. And then I ran into him again and he said, why don't you fly out to Maryland and you could check us out. I kind of liked it, right? Because it's this sort of hybrid environment that takes this way of academic that you could do the research, but then you got to work with industry. And but you don't mandate, right, the standards in industry. You kind of work with them to understand what their needs are. And it was this cool thing. But then what happened there was I kind of felt that I would add a lot more value to NIST if I had a background, an educational background in business. So then I ended up going to business school at nights. And then that I felt was more important, because then when I could talk to a lot of folks in industry, I could really understand if a standard is going to be developed in that instance. I could understand it not just from a metrology perspective, which is what, you know, the passion was, but I could also understand it from an impactful aspect that it would have on their financials. So that was sort of a cool stuff. So my background has always been pure science. That's my love. That's my passion. And it's always been on the DNA component, always knowing that the protein side would be important. But then I did this little business stint. And then by coinkydink, leadership at NCI that I was knowing from a peripheral perspective when I was at NIST, they kind of gave this opportunity as, like they say, it's something that you just can't say no, because it would be a blank slate to create something that wasn't created. And the ability, the risk was high, but the reward would be higher. And that to me was a drive, right? Because you're trying again to carve an area that doesn't really exist, but has the huge potential to make an impact. So like that was like a cool drive for me.
I love this. But I have to, so wait, at which point you got your PhD? Where is that, in Miami?
No. So my PhD, so from Miami, then I moved to Boston.
Yeah.
The PhD is at Boston University.
Okay. And you didn't get it. You're not an MD PhD. We do a lot of research on people. Are you also an MD PhD?
No.
Okay.
No.
Okay. Yeah. But then you're at NIST, they recruit you and you're like, we deal with business. I should get a business degree. So you do that at nights while you're at NIST.
That was a very hard thing to do. Yeah. That was a very hard thing. Yeah.
And then NCI comes to you and like, what are, again, sorry to ask, what are they asking you like at that moment in time? What's their pitch to you? They're like,
so NCI had already cooked in their books that the CPTAC program was going to go forward. That was already blessed when I was at NIST.
Yeah.
And then there were folks there that were working with standards with NIST, already sort of other activities within the biomarker world. It was just by serendipitously that they ran into me. And then there was an individual at NCI at the time, their deputy director, Anna Barker. And then I then looked at it. I said, this would be a cool opportunity. So then I kind of dug a little more. We met, and next thing, magic happened, right? Mm-hmm. But to me, what was cool, but the value was, and then this is where you never really know where your path is. And I tell everyone, never say no, right? Because so here I am at NIST, right? And at NIST, I started out as a PI, and that was to build a program in DNA metrology for free radicals. And in fact, I think, I don't know if it's still there, but it's what, Standard Reference Material 2396, which I did with a colleague that might still be there, Merle Dizdaroglu. And that was to kind of help build their metrology space and standards for the DNA side. Then after doing a couple of activities there, and then after I did a program policy analyst within the office of the director, when I came back to the lab, you know, right? Because you guys got those big buildings at their labs, right? Here at NCI, we call them divisions, you guys call them labs. They wanted to create a brand new group. And the group that I developed for them was the cell and tissue metrology group. And in there, we were developing standards off the genomic side, the proteomic side, imaging side, and other activities. So my background was just perfectly aligned with what NCI already wanted to get off the ground. So when they advertised it, you could see my background, right? They're looking for the diversity and knowledge of standardization, which is what my strength was at NIST now for almost 8 years. And then at the same time, I could be sort of this one that comes from an open perspective and trying to see where the metrology side could move forward, but with a background in biology that would add value to them. It's weird, right? Where you could plan your future, but these tangents could be so much more rewarding, which is exactly what this was.
Well, and even like to that is like, you know, if CPTAC had this idea that phase one was we need to knock out this reproducibility, like that was aim one or phase one.
right.
That's why it was you, right? It wasn't like this more applied phase two, or maybe it wasn't a Henry Rodriguez, but you came on and you were, yeah, like you said, like you were kind of at this perfect person in this perfect time in this perfect place. It's so random. I love it.
Yeah, yeah.
It's really cool.
Phase one was sort of already known, right? What you had to do. The future phases, it's the ones that you got to then start building. So those are the ones, right? So phase two, three, right? So phase one was already sort of done, right? Mm. So the board already said, we want this space. It'll be built around metrology, no biology, period. What comes out of that, that's your gamble, right? So I could be on the street within 5 years, right? I mean, think about it. If they come back, they go, listen, like, we love this space, but but the beauty of the space is the chaos. Nothing is reproducible. You're dead. But the fact that they came back, these investigators, to the credit, they developed these eloquent round robin studies, which is what you do within clinical laboratories, right? Because everybody's reproducible in their own shop. Yeah, kudos. But try and take a sample and flip it among multiple laboratories, and you get tight CVs. That demonstrates just how advanced now you could actually have this platform move forward. And then that's your gamble. Okay, so what's next? So that's where you start working again with your investigators. You bring outside folks, experts, and you're getting those ideas. Listen, now that we did this, what do you guys think? So, yeah.
Super cool. Thank you.
Honestly, Henry, it sounds funny to pivot here, but what are you doing when you're not in the office or are not setting up these international collaborations? I sometimes see that you're working on what hobbies and things. What are you doing?
I'm burned out. So that's a good one. So, I mean, my hobby has always been pure and simple. I enjoy fishing, quite frankly.
Really?
And then lately now, I have to confess, I've grown addicted to pickleball. Uh-huh. So that's not what I do nonstop. Okay. So I think at some point, maybe I'll start joining the circuits in pickleball, but I'll probably lose everyone. But at least it's very rewarding.
Ow. Yeah, no. I swear that was something that came out of nowhere. And now, we'll reserve basketball hoops at the Y up here. And then there are people, the pickleball addicts won't let you have the courts that you reserved.
Yeah.
I mean, it looks like it's fun. My kid likes it.
Yeah. I mean, look, so you talked about, I think you indicated these international ones, right? So like there's another one that I never thought this small idea would have percolated into this larger activity. I think the one they're referring to is that International Cancer Proteogenome Consortium one, right? That ICPC. Yeah. So that thing is again, it's just, you could close your eyes, dream of what could be. And then the hard part is you start pecking away. And what I've always noticed is if you don't think about all the obstacles, you're blind to it, you're ignorant, quite frankly, but in a way that's good, because then you're just willing to basically plow it and try it. And my attitude has always been simple. If you fail, so what? You're back at the same stage you were without even trying. So you really don't lose anything except time and effort. So that one actually was one that really was quite interesting, right? So what, in 2016, that's when, under the Obama-Biden administration, the first cancer moonshot got created. And then in there was, they had officially at the White House, a cancer moonshot task force. And then there was an individual at the NCI that was part of that task force. And they were asking around, hey, they're looking for these creative ideas. So do you have thoughts? So then my thought was a simple one. We CPTAC was already forging, but we had very little, but we're already sort of forging these collaborations with outside groups in other countries. And one of them that we had was with the Korea Institute of Science and Technology in Seoul. And that was with just this incredible talent and investigator. Her name is Myung-Hee Yu. And then what popped in my head was, what if we could take this program of NCI that funds U.S. laboratories, right, CPTAC, and what if we could scale it or replicate it in other countries, but no tax dollars, right? So nothing from the U.S. goes overseas. But we'll forge this sort of collaborative spirit. And what would be good is that it's an opportunity to identify if, for example, if we're studying lung cancer, like lung adenocarcinoma, are there other groups that are studying lung adenocarcinoma? More specifically, are they doing what we do, which is every tumor, you try to also collect its normalization tissue, and you conduct, again, insane depth, comprehensive DNA, RNA, protein sequencing, right? But then we would sort of make this what I would say a data sharing pledge with one another that's linked through these memorandum of understandings. And that is, once we're done with our studies, all that biomedical data gets made public, gets placed in the public domain. That'd be sort of a cool thing. So there what happened was, they kind of liked it. I then ended up calling, you guys likely know Mark Baker, right? So Mark at the time was at Macquarie University. I called Mark up, my nighttime, his morning. And I basically called him and said, look, Mark, I had this crazy idea. I don't know, would you like to bring in Macquarie University if we could do this stuff and sort of link it around the cancer moonshot? So Mark's like, yeah, it sounds really cool. I'm fully on board. So then Mark starts calling some other folks. I start calling some other folks to see the interest in this. Then I also then got introduced to Yuju Chen, which is at Academia Sinica in Taipei, Taiwan. She also loved the idea because she was also percolating to kind of replicate this model of CPTAC. So then the first public announcement that these teams came in was held at Hupil Taipei in 2016. Then like the big, the icing on the cake was in 2017, Hupil was hosting their international conference in Dublin, Ireland. Huge, huge thanks has to go to the Hupil organization and especially Steve Pennington, because then I think we had like 10 countries now involved in this. And the thought was to potentially put on this a gala event, but we wanted to bring in all the different countries or research laboratories that were now involved in forging this international collaboration, which to me, if the end goal is to do similar research, even if it's similar cancer types, but those odds are hard, but knowing the population sets are different, if all that information gets placed in the public, you would really represent cancer, the diversity of cancer at that global scale, which to me is hugely powerful. So to their credit, then we reached out to representatives of Vice President Biden, which was off-boarded at the White House, and we actually hosted this event with him as our special guest. And it was like the cherry on top of that cake. No one would have guessed it. And today this program exists, and now it spans like 14 countries. But again, it's where you have this little small idea, you kind of, say no to all the things that badly could happen, but you kind of have this long-term goal. And at the end, you never know. Some things flourish, some things don't. And that's one that just took off, which was quite very rewarding and still is.
Okay. I actually had it at the top of my notes to ask you about Biden, because, that was such an exciting thing. I wasn't there, but to just see, there's Jenny Van Eyken. I know her, and she's with Joe Biden right now.
Yeah.
That was super cool. And so you recently were also part of the White House, right?
Yeah. I was you just never know, you know, the opportunities that get thrown your way. So now with the Biden, right, Harris administration, the way that came about was that there's always a transition team, right, that helps to quickly populate the staff for every new administration, which, again, like, I had zero clue. So, and apparently my name got thrown in this hat. And then also to the leadership of NCI, they were asking, because there were rumblings on potentially looking again at the Cancer Moonshot activity. And the leadership of NCI then also threw my name in the hat. And then in the end, through a couple of these interview calls, which are very fascinating, and really what they're looking at is the big picture, right? It's they're looking, can you think outside the box? Can you look at obstacles and quickly figure out ways around it? Because everywhere there's going to be an obstacle. But if you just sit there in an obstacle and you stand still, there's minimal value. But you always find out there's ways around it, right? So next thing after those interviews, they basically called back and they said, listen, would you like to do a detailed here? Which was like a no-brainer, right? So like you're really calm initially. Yeah, you know, like that'll be really cool. But deep down, you're just like, oh yeah, right. And it was an experience that really made me appreciate my entire career within the government. It's like the capstone in a way, because you get to see policy level at a way that I never could appreciate it, right? Because when you're at the ground floor, you're focused on activities in the ground floor, and you're sort of not really, it's not that you don't care, but the things at the very top floor, you just see it as whatever happens there. But then for me, I started asking those questions, right? Wow, so how does the top floor make those decisions? Wow, so how does the top floor, you know, policies? Because NCI is not a policymaker, right? But we do the science that does provide valuable information that then helps the policies from these other organizations. And then in that period, which was what, like from 2021 to 2022, it was really cool where I got to be part of seeing how things could be put together, putting data together for the reissuance of the new Cancer Moonshot, which is just an incredible thing, right? With that goal in the span of 25 years to look at the death rates of cancer and just cut it in half, right? And while it involves research, obviously there's a lot more things that you could do than just more research. You could actually make many components more accessible to every American that's there. I also got to interact with folks that were part of the ARPA-H project, what was also working on aspects of pandemic preparedness, diversity in clinical trials. But at the end of the day, one of the cool things that's come out of that, which is public now, was when I was there, I ended up getting a call from a colleague at Sloan Kettering, Larry Norton, who then introduced me to an individual named Alberto Costa. You know, so no idea. But then when I talked to this individual, it turns out he is the advisor of oncology to the commissioner in the EU, who happens to be the commissioner for health and food safety, Stella Kyriakides. And, you know, it's like he starts telling me, hey, listen, we have this thing out here. It's called the European Beating Cancer Plan. You know, it has a beautiful alignment with the Cancer Moonshot in the U.S. Thoughts on aligning our activities, because they're very closely tied in terms of our overall goals and missions. Wow. It's like, yeah. So it was like this coolest thing. So then we have delegates from the EU. They fly to the U.S. Now I'm back at NCI. We even had the commissioner there. she, you know, we had these discussions with her, and it became very apparent to keep these things separate would be okay, but to bring them together would be even better. So today now we're actually have forged these working groups with them that focuses on trying to align a lot of our activities, create new projects. One happens to be in pediatric oncology, especially for rare cancers, which is really important to do, right? Because you typically can't get enough subjects within one country. So teaming up becomes hugely advantageous. And another one focuses on adult lung cancer, likely looking at stuff on cessations. But again, man, guys, it's, you never would envision this walking in, but when you walk out and then you kind of look at this, you go, wow, that was like a fun ride.
Right. That's awesome. Okay. Yeah. Now I figured we would get there, and with or without me getting back to the top of the page. So, this is probably my favorite part of the podcast, what are you most excited about in terms of where proteomics as a field is going? Within any kind of time frame, but what is it that you're most excited about personally?
I personally see it because, well, I mean, this is my own bias, obviously, right? But I honestly see that more and more the information of the protein space is absolutely now being recognized by the oncology community, and the oncology community that focuses on a genomics only approach. And to me, one of the cool stuff was a couple of years ago, I even wrote up a perspective on this that brought in leadership of NCI to help draft this sort of future vision of where the field will be in the next 10 years. And in there, literally the underlying theme is that we gotta bring not just genomics, but merging it with the proteomics landscape into our biomedical research and into these clinical trials. So while it's a slow process, that to me is the biggest win, right? Because that is one where you have these very well-controlled studies and the information that you gather, as long as you benefit the patient, to me, that's the ultimate goal. So to me, that's my short-term most exciting part. And I'm also sort of really fascinated now by a lot of these multi-omic, multimodal panels that are starting to come out more and more because the level of precision behind them, and if you attach that to AI-driven way of looking at the data sets, which is really good, that is, I think, where a lot of this future kind of moves forward to. I mean, at the end of the day, what we're trying to generate, pure and simple, is to have algorithmically guided patient care decisions, right? And especially if it gets focused on treatment for those patients. Because when people talk about precision medicine, I mean, obviously, you know, the diagnosis is absolutely valuable. The early detection is absolutely critical. But at least the way that I always learned it, a lot of it, they would argue the right patient, the right time, the right drug, right? So a lot of that is that treatment side.
Wow. Yeah, no. there's a lot here. This is super fun, Henry. Okay, I'm up against a time constraint, but thank you so much for making time for us.
Yeah, thank you.
Oh, very good. Okay, Neely Osborne.
Yeah.
Neely of what?
Yeah, so this is the part where I read the credits. So first off, the views expressed are solely ours, not our employers. We want to thank Johannes for the intro and exit song, Kayla Kirkwood for our artwork. You can email us at theproteomicshow@gmail.com. Please like, subscribe, stars, thumbs. Yeah, thanks. Bye.